is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
It's Thursday, June 13th, 2019, and this is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Josh Macri, being helped out today by Troy Farkas, especially today. Because we know, Josh,
I need the help.
You are, yeah. And Troy, I need you to look over. First off, check his eyes. If you have a breathalyzer there, can you please check that as well? Because after the Bruins lost last night, I'm a little worried about Josh's condition this morning, because I'm sure A, he's depressed. I'm kind of wondering if B, he's inebriated.
He is not inebriated, but
talking to the mic, Troy.
He's not inebriated. He looks very upset, though. Even though the Red Sox did pull out a win over my Rangers, I enjoy seeing his misery over the Bruins today.
Yeah, because he lives in Boston, regular season at this point means nothing.
Nothing.
Okay? He only goes for the championships.
It's all about the tournaments.
And, right. And the fact that the Bruins eliminated, first off, he's shocked by that. And B, he just, it's going to gnaw on him the whole summer that one of his teams didn't win the title. Okay? So I appreciate you, Troy, checking on him. Josh, I appreciate you showing up today.
Yeah, it's the least I could do, Buster. I got to show up. And in all seriousness, tip of the cap to the St. Louis Blues. I can't even talk. St. Louis Blues, tip of the cap. They earned it. Jordan Binnington especially. Great game last night. When you run into a goalie like that, there's not a whole lot you can do. So the Blues earned it. Happy for their fans. They deserve it.
100%. I concur with everything you just said. All kidding aside, man, he was unbelievable in goal last night. All right, let's get to the news and notes of the day. Yesterday, Tiffany Ortiz, David Ortiz's wife, released a statement that he's improving. Marley Rivera has done such great reporting on this whole story. Talked to Eduardo Nunez, who spoke to David Ortiz on Tuesday. And what Nunez said to Marley was, David said to me, "How are you, homie? How you doing?" And I replied, "Hey, it's not about how I'm doing. It's about how you're doing. You tell me." In this case, on Wednesday, the Dominican Republic's chief prosecutor said that six suspects, including the alleged gunman, have been detained in the shooting of the former Red Sox star Pedro Gomez. Of course, an MLB insider for ESPN was on SportsCenter last night talking about the case.
In a late afternoon press conference here in the Dominican Republic's capital city, the nation's two top justice officials laid out further details on the Sunday shooting of David Ortiz, a beloved figure in this country as well as the United States. Jean Alain Rodriguez, the Dominican Attorney General, said six assailants have been captured and others remain on the run. Rodriguez added that they are also pursuing who organized the entire episode. The Attorney General also added interrogations continue but refused to offer more details out of fear of compromising the investigation. He assured the Dominican people that everyone involved will be captured. Rodriguez said, "We recognize the symbolism that David Ortiz represents and our responsibility for this case to be brought to full closure." The Dominican chief of police, Ney Aldrin Bautista, said this was an organized hit on Ortiz, and whomever organized it offered a total of 400,000 Dominican pesos, about 8,000 U.S. dollars. He also displayed the alleged weapon used in the shooting. Neither official offered a motive for the attempted murder.
At Fenway Park yesterday, the Red Sox played the Rangers. Of course, Boston desperately needing a win, given how they've been playing of late. In the bottom of the fifth inning, they took the lead.
And he'll tag that one to left center field. That is well hit. That one's rising up there. That's off the monster. Chavis churning around third. He's going to score. Benintendi, with his third extra base hit of the day, has put the Red Sox in front 3-2.
Dave O'Brien on Nesson with that call. The two sides were tied 3-3. Bottom of the ninth inning, Mookie Betts came to the plate.
Three balls, one strike, nobody out. 3-3 in the ninth inning. Walk-off situation. Here's the pitch. Low and away, ball four, a walk-off walk, and the Red Sox win it 4-3. Marco Hernandez touches home plate. Mookie down to first with the RBI, a five-pitch walk, and the Red Sox walk it off, literally, with a 4-3 win.
Joe Castiglione, WEI, 93.7 FM. This year has gone so well for the Minnesota Twins, and later in the podcast we'll be talking with Jake Odorizzi. But on Wednesday, tough game for Minnesota.
pitch. Fastball swung on. Sano, off his glove. Bobbles, throws the first. Wide! Long scores. Here comes Malik Smith. He scores. And the Mariners tack on two more. It's 9-6 Seattle here in the 10th.
Dave Sims, 7-10 ESPN Seattle. That would be the final score. Brewers played the Astros. Justin Verlander was excellent. 15 strikeouts in 7 innings. But in the top of the 7th, before Verlander left, Milwaukee tied the score.
1-2 the count. Verlander deals. And Thames in the air to left field. Going back on it is Bradley. And this one is gone! A game-tying home run for Eric Thames.
Brian Anderson on Brewers television. It was still tied. 3-3. Extra innings. Top of the 14th. Mike Moustakas came to the plate with a runner on base.
Perez brings home the pitch. Moustakas, a drive. Deep right center. Way gone. Off the LED signage. In the second deck. Moustakas with number 21. And the Brewers have the lead. It's 5-3.
That from 620 WTMJ, the final score there would be 6-3. The Blue Jays played the Orioles, and Rowdy Tellez came through.
The 2-2. Rowdy rides one down the right field line, headed towards the wall. Goodbye! He thrives in the moment again. It's Rowdy Tellez with one big swing, a grand slam for Rowdy. His second slam of the season. And the Blue Jays have a 6-1 lead.
And Toronto was on its way at that point to an 8-6 win. That call from Sportsnet 590, the Fan. But big picture, the news was not good for the Blue Jays on Wednesday because closer Ken Giles, who was thought to be a major trade target of a lot of contenders, landed on the 10-day injured list with right elbow inflammation. The timing is not good for the Blue Jays. Remind you last summer when Josh Donaldson had all those injury issues leading up to the trade deadline. The Cubs played the Rockies, winning 10-1. Javier Baez punctuated the scoring.
Now Baez waits for the 1-2, and it's on the way, and it's swung on and drilled in the air. Get out the tape measure. Long gone, and Baez watches it go way over the fence in left center. And the Cubs lead 10-0.
Pat Hughes on the Cubs radio network. And the reason why Baez stood and watched is because all day long, these two teams were taking shots at each other's guys getting hit, brushbacks, the whole thing. We'll be talking about that coming up with Joel Sherman of the New York Post and the Major League Baseball Network. The Reds played the Indians. And in the top of the first inning, the Reds took control.
And race right to the big club. Here's a drive to left field. Did he get enough? He did. Senzel starts the game off in fine fashion. His fifth of the season. 1-0 Reds.
This kid can play. I'm telling you, you know, the more you watch Senzel play, the more you're excited about him.
Two runs on 6 hits, covered 7 innings. And here is a long drive to right field. Votto out of here. Reds started off with back-to-back jacks. 2-0. Number 6 for Votto.
That sound from the Reds television network. The Reds would win this game 7-2. Joey Votto did have to leave this game in the middle of it because of mid-back stiffness.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day in Atlanta, the red-hot Atlanta Braves playing the Pittsburgh Pirates. And in the bottom of the first inning, it seemed like the Braves took control of this game.
Driven high in the air to right. Cabrera onto the warning track at the wall. That ball's off the wall. And the Braves are going to score 2. Riley around second, on his way to third. It hit off the top of the padding. And Atlanta has a 3 spot. Wow!
Chip Carey on Fox Sports South with that call. But the Pirates would come back. They would take the lead. Austin Riley, who has demonstrated himself to be so clutch in his first days in the big leagues, came to the plate in the bottom of the 9th.
3-1. Fly ball well hit center. Drifting back Marte at the track, at the wall. It is gone! Riley ties it. He gets quick again.
Austin Riley does it again. Josh, did you hear that crowd when he swung at that pitch and he put it in the air? It's like the crowd in Atlanta is so juiced now by Austin Riley. It's like anytime he gets a ball in the air, it's like, whoa!
As they should be. I mean, not just Riley, but this entire young core is incredibly exciting. The Braves fans have a lot to be excited about.
Yeah, speaking of that, Ozzie Albies came to the plate in the bottom of the 11th. Score still tied, 7-all.
The pitch sucked to the gap in right center field. That's going to get out. It's going to get all the way to the wall. Watch Riley run. He's around second. He's waved around third. He's coming to the plate, and he will score. Braves win. Ozzie Albies whacks one into the right center field gap, and they are mobbing Ozzie. Riley right in the middle of it as the Braves walk off the Pirates in the 11th inning.
That was Jim Powell's 680, the Fan for Atlanta. Six consecutive wins. They have moved into first place in the National League East with a 39-29 record. And Troy Farkas, it's been established here in the podcast that you are a big fan of the Texas Rangers and the best teammate show in the last decade. No question about it. Adrian Beltre, Elvis Andrus, with the way that they would go back and forth and give each other a hard time. Well, we saw again last night why Ozzie Albies, Ronald Acuna Jr., I think they are worthy successors to the great show we saw put on by Beltre and Andrus, given how they go back and forth. In the postgame celebration, Ozzie Albies was getting ready for the interview. He's just waiting for Acuna to come at him, which he did with the Gatorade and then the ice water. Those two guys have so much fun together.
But was there any touching of the other's head like Elvis used to do to Adrian?
No, they don't do that, but they seem to whip each other with towels a lot. Okay, that seems to be what happens. Austin Riley also spoke with Fox Sports South about his big day.
Yeah, good shot. I knew it was in the gap, so I was just, run as hard as I can. If Wash stopped me, he stopped me. If not, he didn't stop me, and it was a good hit by Ozzie, and good team win.
You want to be up in that spot?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, this team thrives off of it, and it kind of gives me that confidence to, get up there and do the same. So, I love being in those situations.
I know you talked about that series in Miami. How nice is it to kind of have this bounce back these last couple of nights?
Even last night, still swung at some sliders, out of the zone, low and away, and, sight me in sight, said, if I can just, lay off those, and, I'm have, a better chance of success. And, I think the second bat, I had three, the sliders away, and then got to 3-0, and then got a pitch to hit, and kind of built from there.
Josh, I noticed a few weeks ago when I talked to Austin Riley that when he's talking in a clubhouse, he kind of whispers, keeps his voice down, like he doesn't want any of his teammates to think that he's making a big deal about himself. And you heard it again right there.
Yeah, no, I like the attitude. I like the drawl too, big time drawl at Austin, and it's a good one.
A Mississippi drawl,
absolutely.
DeSoto Central High School, I think that, if I remember correctly, that's the name of his high school in Mississippi. Really cool there. Joel Sherman covers baseball for the New York Post. You see him all the time on Major League Baseball Network. Joel, thanks for joining us this morning.
It's great to be here, Buster.
All right, so the Braves win again last night. That's six straight, and to me, they're clearly now the team to beat in the National League East because they have this great core of young players, and I think they're getting better as the season goes along. And to me, the most integral question at this point is, will they be able to climb into the next echelon of teams and do better than they did last year when, the Dodgers basically crushed them in the postseason? What do you make of the Braves at this point?
So I thought it was interesting, Buster. Last week I wrote a column for Sunday in the Post about, once we cleared the draft, once we cleared Kimbrel Keuchel signings, it is now trade season, whether it happens quickly or not. It's where everyone's focus turned. And someone said something interesting about how aggressive they thought the Phillies were going to be. And they said they expect the Phillies to be incredibly aggressive, not just because they've been signaling that way with Harper and McCutchen, et cetera, leading into this year and even the year before with Arrieta and Santana, but that the Phillies were logical enough to see the Braves monster, that this might be the most vulnerable the Braves will be in the next 3 to 5 years. And if you don't win the division this year, it could get a lot tougher. And I think to your point, Buster, I think we're seeing the beginning of the monster now, right? Because the seedlings were dropped last year when we saw really the first of Acuna and Albies and some of the pitching. And the depth of their farm system suggests that as we get closer and closer to the deadline, whatever Atlanta perceives as its shortcoming, they are as likely to be in position to answer that because of the depth of their farm system as any team.
Yeah, earlier in the year, I had a conversation with Freddie Freeman who said, I'm so glad they didn't trade any of these guys. And I really feel like that when we talk about the Braves, we got to talk about the work of Alex Anthopoulos, their general manager, who to me excelled because he didn't feel the need to come in and put his stamp on the team. Like he came in and said, you know what? I want to watch these guys for a while and figure out what to do, because we've seen examples in the last decade. A.J. Preller took over the Padres, and sight unseen, he trades Trey Turner and Max Fried. Brody Van Wagenen took over the Mets last fall. Sight unseen, trades Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn. He nearly traded Jeff McNeil. I think Alex is showing us how patience can work as well. What do you think?
I agree with you. I was going to use the Brody example. You used it. It's you start making maneuvers before you fully appreciate how difficult the job is and who exactly you have in your system. And I would say this, if we were sitting with Alex Anthopoulos 12 months ago, Buster, or even today, he's an honest guy and said, who would you have perceived would be your two guys who would burst out to be near the top of your rotation? I'm not sure he would have picked Soroka and Freed. So he would have been as likely to trade Soroka and Freed 12 months ago if he was being quote-unquote aggressive as anything else, right? Like it was hard to tell which of the guys. And so I think even 12 months into this, because of how fickle pitching could be, he's probably somewhat hesitant until he gets even a better read on who his group of pitchers are before he goes and cashes something in and has the Trey Turner, Kelenic kind of regret. It's also another reminder to me that no matter how many times we learn the lesson, we always overreact to the teams that get the shiny toys. Oh, they got blank, who I've heard of, and it's famous and makes a lot of money. And the reality is, last trade deadline, you know who had the best trade deadline? The Tampa Bay Rays. They traded a shiny toy, Chris Archer. They end up with Meadows and Glasnow and one of their better prospects in Shane Boz. Plus, they get Tommy Pham for nothing. On July 31st, when we were all doing assessments of the trade deadline, I think there were probably very few people who were going, you know who really killed it today? The Tampa Bay Rays. When in the offseason, when they signed Charlie Morton, did anybody say, you know who really killed it in the offseason? The Rays. I think there's this temptation of still, with as much as we've learned, it's who gets the shiny toys wins initially, but patience is probably still the greatest virtue in the game.
Yeah, and I think Austin Riley probably be in that same category of Soroka and Max Fried, where a year ago, you know, he was viewed at, okay, he's a good prospect, but we don't know exactly how good he's going to be. But, you know, that great line from his high school coach about how Austin Riley handles failure better than anybody, that we really seen that play out in the big leagues, where we see him make adjustments from day to day, and he looks like he's going to be just a terrific player as we move forward. You know Alex well. What is it in his, you think, in his background, in his personality that had him do his job this way, to be patient?
Well, I think that he's kind of has two things. He waited very patiently, and then at that moment where Toronto finally, after two decades, had a chance to win when he was up there, he was very aggressive. And I know there was some questioning about, wow, look at what he gave up. And it turns out that what he gave up, and you had to wait for a few years, was Matt Boyd and really very little else to do everything he did to get the Blue Jays into consecutive playoffs and get 3 million people to the stadium again. You know, it's also easy to forget in this analytical age that there needs to be emotion from the fans. They want to sense that you're going for it and when you have a chance to win. So I think that if he senses that he's got a shot here without ruining his next 3 to 5 years, he'll go for it. And plus, I think they have a great deal of respect for the folks who've been running the Dodgers the last 4 or 5 years, how they think about length of roster and patience and using money as a spread out virtue as opposed to maybe putting it all in one basket. And Alex was in that front office for 2 or 3 years before he got the job with the Braves. So I think that he's kind of like obviously grown. He's And I do think if I was making a list of teams that will do something of magnitude, they would, them, Minnesota, Philadelphia, Tampa Bay, the Yankees, those feel to me like the teams that are going to do some kind of throw a brick on a gas pedal and go for it a little here.
And boy, it feels like the Braves are in a great competitive situation when it comes to the trade market, because as Freddie said, they haven't traded any of those young starting pitchers that everybody in other organizations love. So, yeah, and you would assume as we move forward that the Braves' focus is going to be on controllable relievers from the group like Brad Hand of the Indians. And I don't think the Nationals would deal with him, but like if they put a Sean Doolittle out there, maybe him, or Felipe Vasquez of the Pirates, it feels like that the Braves will be at the forefront of that conversation. What do you think?
I agree. Let's remember that Alex and Farhan Zaidi work together with the Dodgers. I think they have a very good relationship. Will Smith, who's having another very good, probably his best season, is likely to be out there as well. You know, again, if I was playing the short list game, Buster, it's who's going to end up with a reliever, I would assume the Dodgers, the Braves, for sure. If the Red Sox perceive that they're still strongly in this in another 4 weeks, I would say they'll get a reliever. And you named some really quality guys, and I think what makes the quality guys interesting is time left on their contract. You know, I believe Doolittle has an option. I believe Han has a year and an option. Vasquez is signed to a long-term contract. Will Smith has another year. So the guys we're talking about, and I think I mentioned four left-handers there also, they all have greater value than a singular playoff run. And for someone like Alex, who's thinking, this isn't the only year we want to go for it, his willingness to give up some talent will probably be tied to the ability to add a guy who has more than 1 year. And I would throw in one other guy. I would think that Kirby, as much as the Padres want to try to maximize winning this year, I would assume a guy like Kirby Yates gets out on the market if A.J. Preller hears what he wants to hear.
100%. I totally agree with you on that. You were around the Yankees this week in their series against the Mets. A lot of talk about the Yankees adding a starting pitcher. First off, what are some names you think that the Yankees will consider, and what do you make of a possible link between Madison Bumgarner and the Yankees?
Yeah, I think that Bumgarner becomes attracted to the Yankees, Buster, almost for the they passed on Verlander, they passed on Hamels, two guys who were not in great situations where maybe you thought, are they beginning to fade? And then they went to strong teams, strong analytic teams, and suddenly those guys were almost as good, if not or better, than they had ever been. And there's probably a little bit of feeling with Bumgarner. If you get him as analytically driven as the new front office is, it was a mom-and-pop store for a long time. What happens if you get him out of there? What if you get one of the great big-game postseason pitchers back into the verve of it? But I know, Buster, how well you know the organization. The Yankees really love two things when it comes to starting pitchers: high strikeout rates and high ground ball rates. And Bumgarner is not a ground ball pitcher and gets away with some stuff, I think, because he does play in a big ballpark in the National League. I'd wonder if they'd have a little bit of concern about that. Now, their need for the starter is going to be great enough, and his track record is great enough that I think the Yankees will be in on him. And without much proof except for history around the team of sensing what they like, if Zach Wheeler were to become available, if the Mets fell out of this, or Syndergaard, who they tried to get in the offseason in a three-way trade with the Mets and the Marlins when the Mets were trying to get Real Muto, became available, I almost wonder, because of the stuff and the way and what happens with the stuff as far as ground balls and strikeouts, I almost wonder if they do it. And I'm curious, Buster, because the trade market for starting pitching might change a little. I think 4 weeks ago we would have said Mike Minor is in it. Is he? The Rangers are the second AL wild card today. Maybe that's not going to happen. Or Lance Lynn, who the Yankees obviously got last year. Are the Yankees or other teams, do you have to have a little concern about bringing a Trevor Bauer, that kind of eccentric personality, into New York? into the Yankee clubhouse. So even if he is available, and I perceive he probably will be available, is that the kind of guy? Look, the marketplace might not be as broad for starting pitching as we anticipate today.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I don't think there are as many teams as there have been in the past that are going to be out and as many contenders actually looking for starting pitching. And so, you know, when you have a Marcus Stroman, an Aaron Sanchez, a Bumgarner, Matt Boyd, who I wouldn't be surprised if the Yankees begin to hone in on him a little bit. I almost feel like that you're going to have more sellers than buyers in the starting pitching market. And I, you know, knowing the Yankees and how Brian Cashman works, it wouldn't surprise me if they were patient in that regard. Real quick on the Indians, I want to follow up on, you mentioned Trevor Bauer. Look, they're going to be open to discussing Brad Hand and Trevor Bauer this summer. And I find myself, I did radio again in Cleveland yesterday, and I find myself so often defending the thought process of the front office. I know Indians fans don't want to hear it, but when you look at the cycles that teams go through in baseball where, you know, they try to win and then they tank or they rebuild and they're awful for 4 or 5 years, I totally get what the Indians are doing, and I think they're actually doing a pretty good job with it, taking advantage of the value of the players when potentially it's at its peak, which is what you're going to have with Bauer this summer, which is what you're going to have with Brad Hand. And what you're seeing is the team isn't going to go through one of those down cycles. They're threading the needle into the that next potential period of success. What do you think?
Well, Buster, I know you've written and spoken about this subject a lot, which is the problems of so many teams going into complete tanking nosedives and what that does to fan bases and competitive balance and historical numbers. I mean, it's a problem in the game. And therefore, I always admire Tampa Bay, Oakland, and Cleveland specifically stand out that with whatever their finances are, they're always trying to win as many games as yep. they could within those seasons, as opposed to simply saying, well, we'll take a year or two to do it. And I agree with you. When I talk to front office people from other teams, there is great admiration for the, you know, the front office of the Indians, you know, in Mike Chernoff, Chris Antonetti, and that they say those guys recognize that their best chance to win was probably the 16, 17, and maybe even the 18 windows when their starting pitching was mainly healthy, when Andrew Miller was a huge force in the bullpen and Cody Allen before last year was a strong end game presence, and that they don't have that unit now. They're coming towards the end on some guys. You know, Bauer's about to get very expensive as a free agent after 20. Kluber's had a couple of physical breakdowns now, where maybe he's lost some of his value. And they're not going to ruin the next 5 years chasing what's almost certainly at best the second wild card this year. At this point, you'd have to have a dramatic Minnesota Twin collapse over the last 60% of this season. And I guess, you know, you could say, oh, these Twin guys, they've never been there before. The Indian guy, most of the Indian guys have. Maybe there will be that collapse. But the Indian front office is too smart to invest in pipe dreams of coming back from 10, 11 down, even this still somewhat early in the season. And therefore, I think if they see a chance to create financial flexibility and add stronger talent base and think of what does our 20 to 20, 24 team look like, they're just too aggressively smart not to capitalize on it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, their chances, according to FanGraphs this morning, to win the division are at 5.8%. They're aware of those numbers. They're going to follow those numbers, and they're going to objectively evaluate their chances. And because I think they're going to trade Bauer and I think they're going to trade Brad Hand, they'll improve their chances for making the playoffs in 2020 and 2021 and 22 and 23. That's a whole lot better to me. Trying to do that than going through 3 years where you're just not relevant and you're not competitive. Real quick, wanted you to hear this. You've been covering a baseball a long time like I have. This was the classic old school back and forth that we saw between the Rockies and the Cubs yesterday, where a couple days ago, Chris Bryant got hit by pitches twice. And then yesterday, Javier Baez got a pitch up and in. Nolan Arenado came to the plate. He got hit, and that just set off a series of events. Give a listen to this rip of highlights from what happened yesterday.
Nolan walked. They pitched around him, it looked like, in the first with traffic, and Nolan gets drilled, and Nolan's ticked off.
It's John at the Cubs dugout, too.
Umpires getting between the two. Roberto Ortiz, he said something to the dugout as well.
Arenado thought it was intentional. Well, remember now, in the top of the inning, Baez had to hit the deck after he was facing Senzatella.
Can't read intent, but I think this is definitely a case of Cole Hamels going, we're going to push back. You're drilling our guy. I'm going to at least push you off the plate. If you get out of the way, fine. If not, take your base.
That's the last thing you want to see. And now he's got to come out. McMahon goes in.
This game is still very much in the balance. Now you're going to play without your best player.
It was nice to get a fourth plate appearance as a starting pitcher. Well, Hamels gets hit. I felt that was a situation where it might happen.
That's a cutter, a slider down and in, thrown behind him where you go after it, and that's one way of hitting a guy but not making it overly obvious.
Well, the plot thickens a little bit, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Now, if that ball is up, I think Bryant might get thrown out of the game.
Interesting. Just skimmed him on a pitch on the inside. Some of the Chicago fans boo. A few Rockies fans applauded.
So, Joel, after that, Anthony Rizzo got hit. There's another batter hit at some point. And then after the game, Nolan Arenado, the Rockies third baseman, told reporters that if they played again this year, because this is the last game between the two teams this year, it would get spicy. And basically Cole Hamels looked at reporters with a straight face and said, no, you know, that's baseball. Nothing going on. You and I have heard a lot of players say they take care of business on the field. And this was a great example of that.
Yeah, and I used to be vexed by what the right thing is, but I constantly come to this, Buster, is if this practice never existed before, this kind of like eye for an eye situation, and it was proposed today. We're sitting around, there's a room full of baseball executives, commissioner's office, the union. They say, look, we're worried about some stuff that's happening on the field. So from now on, if one of our guys gets thrown at, what we're going to do is we're going to take a baseball and we're going to heave it 90 miles an hour plus, and we're going to do it right. So, you know, doing it right, like we're at a 10-year high for walks. We're at an all-time high for hit by pitches. Obviously, if pitchers had great control, neither of those would be true. And so therefore, this idea, I'm going to do it right, maybe I'll hit you in your butt, or maybe I'll hit you in your ribs, or maybe I'll hit you in the wrist, or heaven forbid, the worst, but I'll hit you in your head. It would be crazy to have that conversation if it never existed before. The only reason we keep doing it is it's one of these traditions of the game, which is we're going to settle it on the field. And to me, the risk-reward is so problematic that I feel the commissioner's office and the union need to step in a stronger way and say, look, we're going to have some kind of commission, and if we decide that you did this on purpose, the penalties are going to be a lot stronger than they are now, because it's like netting around the field. Why are we waiting for the horror show before we just do the right thing? I mean, is the horror show some Tony Conigliaro kind of thing again, where somebody loses their career essentially again, or worse? We've certainly seen a lot of situations, you know, when Yankees late last year losing Judge for 7 weeks. I mean, there's just a lot of guys lost to hit by pitch. I think the frontier justice machismo, I think it has to be legislated in a stronger way.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And this, add this to the long list of things where it would be great if the Major League Baseball and the union would be talking about it. But as you know, the relationship right now is as bad as it's been in about 25 years. And it's too bad that those type of conversations aren't going on. Joel, thanks for doing this. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back in a moment with Jake Odorizzi. But first, I want to tell you about DXL.
Listen up, guys. If you're big or tall, you know what a pain it is to find clothes that fit. So a trip to DXL needs to be on your to-do list. At DXL, big and tall is all they do. They spent years developing their own sizing patterns to make sure big guys get a comfortable fit every time. Pair that with over 100 brands, and you've got the one-stop shop for men's big and tall. Whether you're looking for jeans, hoodies, suits, or shoes, DXL's got you covered for every occasion, in stores or online at DXL.com. DXL, big and tall, built for you at DXL.com.
Jake Odorizzi of the Minnesota Twins is in his eighth year in the big leagues and having his best season, a league best 1.92 ERA. Your last eight starts, Jake, four runs allowed. Opponents hitting 170 this year. You are obviously looking at a situation in which you might have your first All-Star appearance. How meaningful would that be for you?
It'd be a great honor. It's something that I think everybody strives for, and I'm no different. I think that's everybody's goal. But from my viewpoint, a starting pitching, person making the All-Star game, I think has a lot to do with the team that they're on too, because it takes the eight other guys behind you to play, at a high level to have, the success that a starting pitcher has. So it's one of those things where you can't do it all yourself. And I got a great group of guys behind me that have been outstanding this year. So I think it's more of a team honor when a starting pitcher is recognized for something along those lines.
If you do get that experience to go to Cleveland, what would you be looking forward to seeing or doing the most?
I honestly don't know. I've never really been in that position. So I think just taking it in, talking with other guys, just enjoying the moment, really. I don't think I have any expectations of it just because I've never, had to go through anything like that. So I'm just would go in open-minded, happy, and just, try to take in as much as I can in the short amount of time that you're there.
All right, you mentioned the success of the team this year. When did you start to get, because, dopes like me were basically conceding the division to the Indians this year, thinking that they were going to run away with it. When did you and maybe some of your teammates start to get the sense of, we could be pretty good here?
Yeah, I think it kind of came together in spring training. I know a lot of teams say that, but, we had a different regiment this spring with Rocco coming in and changing the flow of spring training. I think guys really enjoyed that, bought into it. And, we had a lot of talent on the roster, top to bottom. We had a lot of, we had a lot of guys this offseason and a lot of guys that were looking to prove something coming in from last year. So, I think that with a mix of how we ran things, we came together very quickly. And, like we knew, going into this season, if we wanted to win this division, we were going to have to take it. No one was going to hand it to us. So we were the team kind of looking to make a stand, and we came out, and we've been obviously the home runs are at a outstanding rate right now. It's been well documented, but I don't feel like we're ever out of any game. We're always a couple swings away from tying it up or getting a lead. So it's been a fun team to watch this year, and I think as the summer goes on, it'll be a lot of fun for everybody up here in Minnesota to come out to the games and see it for themselves.
You mentioned Rocco Baldelli. You, of course, knew him from your time when you were with the Rays. Tell me when the first time that you heard about him being linked to the Minnesota job, and I'm assuming I know Derek Falvey well enough to know, he at some point maybe he reached out to you to just ask you some impressions about Rocco and what you were thinking about as he was going through that.
Yeah, Derek talked to me because the other top candidate for us was Derek Shelton, our bench coach, and I had known them both for a very long time in Tampa. So either way they were going to go was going to be a good direction with whoever was going to be in charge. But my time with Rocco in Tampa, I got to see him do so many different jobs. He went from being a special assistant to being the bench coach, but the first base coach, outfield coach, and everything that I saw him do, he did at a very high level. So I knew he'd probably take that same stance into managing, and that's exactly what he did. He came into spring, didn't try to put his stamp on everybody, make it, his team. He just wanted to be the guy that was putting people in the best situations to win. And he really did a great job of letting every, coaching head of, hitting coach, pitching coach, do everything that they were supposed to do. And he oversaw it instead of just, trying to be hands-on on everything. So a big credit to him for how he's, attacked being a first-year manager, because it's a very tough gig, especially when you're new to it.
When you were with the Rays, your center fielder was Kevin Kiermaier, and now you have Byron Buxton playing center field. I'm going to ask the impossible of you and compare the two of them, and what's it like pitching with those guys behind you?
I was actually just talking the other day. We were in Tampa, and I was talking with Kyle Gibson. I said, man, I'm pretty fortunate in my career so far. I've had Kiermaier and I've go to Buxton. So not too often you go from one Platinum Glove winner to the next, and it doesn't seem like you miss a beat. So the comp between the two, they're very similar. I mean, defensively, they're the two best in the game. And the way Buck covers ground, I think, is one of the more impressive things that I've ever seen. It just kind of looks like he's gliding out there, and gets the balls that nobody else would even, you know, get close to. And he's one of those guys that are going to go into the wall for you, go over the wall for you. KK was the exact same way. So, like I said, I've just been spoiled for my career, especially with, you know, me being a fly ball guy. Anytime it goes up anywhere towards center field, I'm very confident that it's going to be caught. And if it isn't, I know, you know, that nobody else in the game is going to catch it either. So, it's just been, like I said, I got into a lucky situation with both those guys, and they both had my back more times than not. So I'm pretty fortunate.
It seems like, and you know them far better than I do, but just in talking with both those guys, they hunt fly balls. Like, they hunt for opportunities. Kevin, I remember him telling me once about a play that he envisioned that maybe he would make at some point in a game. I can't remember the circumstances, but it was like these two guys dream about tracking down fly balls in the gap.
They do, and they, you know, they have a mindset of a defensive first mindset, and they want to attack the baseball, whereas a lot of guys kind of sit there and read it. I think they're the ones that are making the read quicker than anybody else and going straight to position. I mean, they work on their craft so well, and to see the work that they put in going into a game, and it makes you understand why they make those plays look so effortless and easy sometimes, because of the preparation that they put themselves through. And they take so much pride in having great defense, because they know, you know, even if it's a tough day at the plate, they can save 1, 2, 3 runs in the field by just being themselves. So I think that's where the difference maker is. And then when you get the offensive production like Buck's putting out this year, I mean, I've said it before, I think he's the most important player on this team for what he does defensively alone, and then offensively now getting, you know, rounding out our lineup and really coming into his own. So it's been fun to see him grow into the player that he's becoming this year.
So I was looking at your numbers. You've had a velocity jump this year. Typically in your first years in the big leagues, you're, you know, 90, 91 average fastball velocity. This year you're up to 92.8, highest of your career. Swing and miss rate, 12.8%, highest of your career. Contact rate in the strike zone, way down. I know, you know, it's in preparing for this interview, I was reading a lot of stories about you through the years. You've gone through an evolution of thought, it seems, in how to pitch. Where are you right now?
Just at a point of where I've felt I'm most comfortable since I've been in the big leagues. The last 2 years, I just had a little back issue mechanically, threw me off a little bit. And like physically, last year I was fine. I just was fighting all the mechanical issues from 17. So it was a very frustrating year for me, from a standpoint where I felt good, but my body, my mechanics were just out of whack. So I went to the Florida Baseball Ranch in Plant City, which I've talked about quite a few times with Randy Sullivan, and Kyle Gibson had used him the year before, and he had a career year. So I live right outside, you know, in Tampa, so I decided to go make an effort to go get my mechanics back in order. And the mobility work, the separation that I have now from my lower half to upper half is making a gigantic difference in the direction of, you know, my pitches, and I can feel like I'm getting everything going to home instead of being a little bit rotational. So it's really helped me with, you know, gaining velocity, and it's just kind of a byproduct of getting back to good mechanics with, you know, like I said, my mindset's a little different now. You know, there's so much information out there with pitch tunneling, spin rate, blah, blah, blah. You know, the list goes on and on, but I really learned, you know, through him, through Wes Johnson, using my stuff a little bit differently and maybe a little more effectively. And I think it shows from start to start. I just feel consistent with my repertoire. I'm knowing what pitches are the shape of what they're going to be doing, you know, before I release them. And it really helps me navigate a lineup when I have full control and confidence of what I'm doing.
Jake, last one for you. Again, I'm always fascinated by pitching adjustments. I've heard of a lot of pitchers who talk about, you know what, I need to increase my tempo. I want to get the ball. And you see Wade Miley do this with the Houston Astros. And at the beginning of your career, you were one of the fastest working pitchers in baseball, 20, 21 seconds between pitches. The last couple of years, that's gone to down to like 26 seconds. And I'm curious what was behind that thought process.
You know, it's just one of those things. I feel like they, with the game speeding up as it is, it's great to be quick. You know, I throw 5 different pitches, so sometimes it takes a little bit to get to the right pitch if we're not on the same page, and some days are different than other days. So I think it's not as, you know, some guys are get it and go, that sort of a thing, whereas, yeah, I like to kind of the hitter's swing, you know, process it for myself, and then make a decision on the next pitch rather than a Chris Sale where, you know, Chris is fantastic. And then I think there's that story where he doesn't shake off. He just throws whatever the catcher puts down, and he's got fantastic stuff to do that, whereas I'm more of a pitcher, and I need to analyze what's going on, what the previous pitch was, what I want to do, you know, the next pitch, and so on and so forth. So I think there's a little more thought behind what I'm trying to do on the mound as opposed to just grabbing it and go. And it's just a byproduct of, you know, what I think I need to do to be successful. So there's no no glaring reason of you know, adding 5 seconds besides the fact of I just want to make sure that I'm throwing the correct pitch at the right time.
Well, it's obviously working for you. Congrats on your start, and I'll be rooting for you to be in Cleveland. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Langs, but first I want to tell you about ButcherBox. Summer is here, and you know what that means. It's barbecue season. And if you're like me, you'll be serving your friends and family the incredible meat from ButcherBox. I just got a shipment last week, and man, great hamburgers. Great chicken, and they sent bacon that was out of this world. I love the bacon. From grass-fed beef to free-range organic chicken to wild-caught sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay, Alaska, ButcherBox has over 20 different cuts of meat to choose from, with customizable boxes and a variety of other options to choose from. They work closely with the best farms and companies committed to raising animals humanely. This ensures not only an ethical process, but one that results in a better quality, better tasting, nutrient-dense meat with no added hormones or antibiotics ever. ButcherBox is delivered right to your door with free shipping. And a month's worth of meat from ButcherBox comes out to less than $6 a meal. Whether you're cooking for all your friends and family or just for yourself, ButcherBox has the cuts and options you need to make every meal a memorable one. And ButcherBox is offering new members free bacon for the life of your subscription, plus $20 off your first box when you sign up at ButcherBox.com/BBTN. That's free bacon. I love the bacon. For the life of your subscription, plus $20 off your first box at ButcherBox.com/BBTN. This is the last week left to get this amazing offer. Don't miss out. Sign up now at ButcherBox.com/BBTN.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and producer for MLB.com. Sarah, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster. Happy to be here.
All right. Absolutely. So I was talking with Joel Sherman, and he agrees with me that we think now it's clearly the Braves division to lose the National League East. Would you agree with that? What do you think?
Oh, definitely. Obviously the addition of Keuchel made them so much better. But the thing is that, you know, Mike Soroka and these other guys have been carrying them. Look at that game last night. It feels like they have the momentum right now, you know, and the Phillies had a really good start at one point, but they're a little bit grasping.
Yeah. And you wonder how that's going to affect decisions by the Mets and by the Nationals, seeing the Braves, how well they're playing, you know, how they're taking off, and whether or not the Mets and Nationals will actually decide to be sellers before the July 31st trade deadline. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 24. That's how many times the Brewers struck out at the plate on Wednesday night. 24 times. You can look at it as the hitting strikeouts or the Astros pitching strikeouts. They struck out 24 batters, but either way, it's already the seventh time this season that a team has had 20 or more strikeouts in a game. That is tied for the most such games in a season in MLB history with last year, and it is June 13th, and they haven't played yet for June 13th, so it's really June 12th. Two of those teams to strike out 20 times at the plate have won the game. The Brewers last night and the Rockies on May 14th against the Red Sox. That's one shy of the most 20 strikeout wins, which was three last year. But we already have as many 20 strikeout games by teams as we had had in any season in MLB history.
Number two
is 22. So 22 of those 24 strikeouts for the Brewers at the plate were swinging. Each of the first 22, by the way. They did not strike out looking until the 13th inning when Orlando Arcia did it. It's the most for any team since we have pitch tracking data, which goes back to 2008. So there were just two games with even 20 swinging strikeouts by one team. The prior record was 21, by Yankees pitchers against Cubs hitters in that Sunday night game in 2017 that I'm sure you remember, Buster, in Chicago, that yes. went for quite a long time. I was there as well. And Justin Verlander had a career-high 15 strikeouts, and they were all swinging. It's just the fifth time in the pitch-tracking era that a pitcher has had 15 or more swinging strikeouts in a game. And it's just the third time a pitcher has had that many swinging strikeouts and none looking. Max Scherzer did it in 2012, and Carlos Carrasco did it in 2015.
Number one
is 30. And that's how many batted balls Hunter Pence has this season, with an exit velocity of 105 miles an hour or more. So that's 10 miles an hour more than what we designate a hard hit ball, right? Because that's 95. We're talking about 105. He hit a double 107.2 miles an hour yesterday, and he's been hitting just so much and so well. He already has more batted balls, hit at least 105 miles an hour or more than all of last season. And he's just 15 shy of his most in a season since 2015, which was 45 in 2016. And it's only mid-June. He has 27 extra base hits in 51 games. He had 16 extra base hits last year and 31 in 2017. And I just think, I mean, I think he's the hands down comeback player of the year in the American League in baseball. And it's just been such a fun story because, you know, he's just one of those players where when he has a season like this, where no one expected him to do anything and he's having this great season, like he's even more fun, right? Because he's just such a fun player to watch.
Oh, and he's so unorthodox with his style. All right, before you go, you and I love numbers in the same way. And I wanted to run these numbers and get your reaction from you, past you, as they get ready for Sunday Night Baseball. Hyunjin Ryu is going to pitch, and I was looking at this. This year, runners in scoring position against Ryu, opponents are 2-54 with one walk and 12 strikeouts. With runners in scoring position in two outs, 0-26, five strikeouts. What do you think?
That's incredible. You know, he's having like a DeGrom type season, not with the team necessarily losing the games, although they did lose his last start. We talked about that on Tuesday, but he's not getting nearly enough attention. I mean, I think he's allowed.
Oh, we're starting it this weekend. We're going to go nuts this weekend.
Good. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And, you know, hands down, I mean, just incredible. Again, I think it's 13 runs all year. That's what I think I talked about that when we talked about Joe Kelly, who's allowed 20, right? I mean, it's so exciting to see this coming because I think that we saw shades of this from him throughout his career, and he had some injury issues and all that other stuff. But to see him put it all together, like, this is amazing.
It's amazing. I got about 10 other numbers on Ryu we're going to talk about on Sunday night. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster. Three very good Bleacher Tweets today. First one from P.K. Steinberg, of course, at P.K. Steinberg.
P.K.
wants to know which team so far this season has most defied expectations? Rena Bonina's Minnesota Twins or Troy Farkas's Texas Rangers?
I got to tell you, you know, I thought this is a great question. And, you know, coming into the year, I thought there was a chance that Minnesota would catch up to the Indians. Like, I thought the Indians would win this division eventually, but I thought the Twins had a chance. I had no thought that the Texas Rangers would be a team that would be over 500, because it seemed like this year was going to be all about rebuilding. So, you know what? I'm more surprised by the Rangers. What about you?
The Rangers have had a great year, and I don't want to take anything away from that. I just remember, as I've said before on the show, back in February and March, it was a foregone conclusion that the Indians were going to run away with the Central. And it's been as much about the Indians' failures as it has about the Twins' success. But to see where the Twins are, I'd say that's probably a little bit more surprising to me, taking nothing away from what the Rangers have done. Jason Amico, at Jason Amico, wants to know, where do you think Will Smith will go at the deadline? Now that the Cubs got Kimbrel, I think the Dodgers, Phillies, Red Sox, Brewers, ironically enough, because he came from there, and Twins could all use him. But Jason says Boston makes the most sense to him.
Yeah, the Red Sox have the greatest need, Jason, but I think in a competitive situation where teams are offering up prospects to the Giants to trade for him, I don't think the Red Sox are going to get him because they're at a disadvantage. You know, as we've talked about all year, in 2019, the credit card bill has come due, Josh.
No,
like
no
all
question
the
about
money
it.
Spent. And nope. This isn't all criticism. It just all those prospects given up for guys like Chris Sale, all the money spent, the bill has come due.
No question about it. But hey, you know, if you end up winning a title, it's worth it. So it is what it is. Finally, Matt Spiegel at Spiegs 1027 says Austin Riley's emergence has made it very easy to forget all about Ender Inciarte. How should the Braves plan to use Ender when he returns from the IL?
First off, Austin Riley's going to keep playing.
You
right?
think?
Whatever happens, Austin Riley is going to continue to play. I think it's the classic line for managers, oh, he's in the mix. Ender right. Inciarte is going to be in the mix on a daily basis. They're probably using to give Acuna a day off. They'll give him to give Nick Markakis a day off. Austin Riley will get occasionally a day off. Josh Donaldson will get a day off, and they'll move Riley into third base. But Austin Riley's going to play, and I think he's going to play more than Ender is.
Yeah, as he should. He's certainly earned the time. And you've earned the right to continue to tweet at us using the hashtag BleacherTweets. Boy, that was a bad segue, Buster. I apologize for that. I'm going to go take a nap.
No, I understand, because we know you didn't get any sleep.
Yeah.
We know you probably imbibed quite a bit after that defeat last night.
That's your opinion.
but I understand. I could hear you when you got halfway through that sentence and you had no idea where the exit ramp was.
Goodbye, everybody.
Exactly. Well, that's it for today. My thanks to Jake Odorizzi, to Sarah Langs, to Joel Sherman, to Josh Macri, to Troy Farkas. Just go get some sleep.
Thank you, Buster.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.